here. That was supposed to be a joke. Obviously, it didn't work. So, let's see. Ah, okay. Yeah, it is. And actually, I realized that I have to restart this. My God. Oh, right. No. Okay. Now it comes. Okay, so here's the outline. So first I will give you some introduction again to transplanting physics. It will also include a little bit about the possibility of detecting these effects, actually. I will then move on to, and that will really be the focus of my talk, I mean, where does these really initial conditions come from? I mean, it will also relate to these various ways of looking at the thing, whether you're supposed to put the conditions at a fixed scale or a fixed time. And I will discuss a little bit about that. Then I will claim that some of the physics that goes into this has some kind of connection also with the information paradox, that you can actually draw some conclusions from there. And here the talk will get more and more speculative. And I will also discuss that this has to do with the possibility of, through the CMBR, actually look back in time. How far back in time can you look? There will be, I claim, limitations on that. I mean, how long inflation lasts and so on. I will then end with some conclusions, and before getting there, we'll also discuss a little bit about string theory and show you a picture of the string landscape, which I don't think that you have seen here during the conferences yet. So, starting then with transplanting physics. So, first, just sort of the general set of things. And obviously, nowadays, when you talk about cosmology, about the early universe, you typically end up discussing inflation. And that is what I will also be discussing here. That will be the obvious framework. Now, inflation is basically a classical thing. There's the classical field, which is moving in the potential, which originally was quite ad hoc. And from there, you could calculate how the universe would expand and match on and try to solve various problems of cosmology. If that had been the whole story, it wouldn't have been that much. But now we know that by adding a few little bit of quantum mechanics, we can also get a successful description of the fluctuations of the CMBR. Now, clearly, you would like to have a better understanding of where inflation comes from, of the shape of the potential, etc. You need a much more fundamental theory to do that. Now, clearly, that will be presumably a theory of quantum gravity, maybe string theory that could do that for you. And during the last several years, there have been a lot of work focusing on this arrow there, trying out of string theory, extract some kind of a prediction of how inflation would be realized in practice. But there is also another less traveled route here. Because essentially, apart from these quantum fluctuations, this is really a rather classical picture. But we think that there are more to this than this. There should also be maybe some effects coming out of true quantum gravity effects, space-time foam, whatever, and that also could enter into the game. And obviously, this is where the transplanting issue comes in, and what has been discussed in several talks, and I will mention more about that, is that that kind of physics actually can leave an imprint on the CMBR, on the sky. Also, which I will not discuss very much today, even though Rich mentioned it a little bit, there is also the issue about back reaction. And one can also discuss in what way this kind of physics actually also will affect the way that the universe expands using inflation. So that is an interesting subject in itself. Now, the thing which is really missing here is obviously this arrow here. And that is really due to our limited understanding of string theory or any other quantum gravity theory. We know very little about how to do this. String theory, typically, we do calculations, get effective field theory, and then we work with classical physics from there. But this arrow there, how to really get a feeling of how this space-time foam, whatever, works, that's something that we know very little about. And so far, we have been, it's more like some kind of phenomenology. We play with different possibilities here, but we cannot really relate it to a truly fundamental theory yet. Hopefully, within, for instance, string theory, we may be able to solve that eventually. Now, let me now just talk a little bit about the general picture of Trans-Planckian physics. Now, the diagram here is more or less the same as the one that Robert drew. You have to rotate it 90 degrees and reflect it, and then you get the same thing. So this is the horizon before, during inflation, and after inflation. And there's someone looking. And then the idea is then that modes are created out of this high energy regime, go out through the horizon, come back in again, and we see them. And this happens again and again. And the idea then is that physics happening here at high energy scales will eventually leave an imprint on the sky. And you can also do calculations here to show that if you have at least 60, 70 e-foldings, a little bit more than inflation in itself requires, then actually there will be physics at the Planck scale that eventually will affect this. So that is the general picture. Now, if the physics here, the initial effective initial state for these modes, is different from the Bunch-Davis, what will happen is that there are various pieces of the fields that will interfere with each other, and there will be some kind of modulations, oscillations, which are taking place after the field leaves this Planckian regime and going out through the horizon and freeze. Then they come back in again, and there are the standard acoustic oscillations. So it's sort of two different sources to get oscillations in the CMBR spectrum, and the idea is that these Trans-Planckian small oscillations then will give a little imprint on the large acoustic oscillation. So that's the general idea. Now, if you make some little toy models here, the kind of generic expectation is that you get a modulation of the spectrum which is related to the way that a ratio between the fundamental scale, which might not be the Planck scale, could be the string scale, and the Hubble scale. And the oscillations of the spectrum is only there, obviously, if H, the Hubble scale, is actually changing during the time in which inflation proceeds. So different modes leaving and having a different amplitude since they are associated with a different value of the Hubble constant. So it's important that there is some kind of a rolling of the Hubble constant. And you can also make some calculations and then show the generic way that these things look like. Now, this is something which is quite important when it comes to the actual detectability of these effects. It's important that the Hubble scale actually changes during inflation. There is a slow roll, and that slow roll has to be of an appropriate magnitude. Otherwise, these effects will be very difficult to see. Now, you can, in this very simple toy model, make calculations then which involve then the epsilon, the slow roll parameter, and other parameters here to derive expressions for the amplitude as given here by the slow roll parameter and this gamma here, which relates this fundamental scale to the Planck scale, and also this ratio here, which determines then the period of these oscillations in the spectrum. And clearly here, you would like, if you are looking at the CMBR, that you would fit at least one, or rather several periods within the window corresponding to the, let's say, the W measurements. Not too many, because then if they're changing too rapidly, you wouldn't see them. So it should be just right. Now, that turns out to give, so this would be an appropriate example. This gives rather stringent restrictions on what kind of values you can play around with. And it turns out that the typical values for the epsilon, the slow load parameter epsilon, is of the order of 1% or so, which is quite okay as far as the measurements are concerned. It might very well end up somewhere there. Now, this is also, by the way, these kind of values for the string scale, which this corresponds to, is also, it's a couple of order of magnitudes below the Planck scale, and that is the kind of thing that you end up with in the heterotrophic string. Now, you can also push these values a little bit further if you allow for having oscillations which have a lot longer period, including then input also from large-scale structure. And it turns out that roughly 10 e-foldings or so is what you might fit between the CMBR and the large-scale structure. And doing that, you can push these parameters a little bit. You can allow a much larger amplitude and a much longer period. And what this will actually correspond to would be some kind of a running of the spectral index from the large-scale structure to the CMBR. And that allows you to actually lower the scale of this fundamental physics a little bit. But you can't do that much to epsilon. So in these toy models, it seems that you really need to have an epsilon which is of this order of magnitude. That would also require the presence of tensor perturbations to the spectrum. Now, we don't know whether they are there. It could very well be that this epsilon is much smaller and the tensor perturbations are not there. And in that case, these kind of effects will be extremely difficult to see. Here, there is also a connection also with string theory, you might say. Because also in string theory, there's an issue about this epsilon and what the value actually is. And it turns out, though, although one cannot rigorously prove this in general, but in a large set of models in string theory, epsilon is vanishingly small, extremely small. For instance, if you look at models which are based on B-brains moving in long throats, you end up with extremely small values. So this picture here is supposed to show the compact six dimensions of some kind of a string flux compactification. And here you have a long throat. And inflation is supposed to be taking place with a, let's say, a D3 brain, represented by that point, moving through the throat and hitting another D3 brain here. And each of these points are actually corresponding to brains extending in three space dimensions in one time. So this is inflation. It goes down the tube there and hits the other one. And that's the end of inflation, reheating, and big bang. Now, the problem is that even though with warping and all of that, these extra dimensions cannot be as large as you like. And it means that these D3 brains can only move a certain limited distance. And that also translates into a limitation on epsilon. And out of these models, it's very, very difficult to get epsilons which are anywhere near those values that I was needed in the last picture here and would also lead to measurable tensor perturbations. So
the 10 to the 18 G is
not. Now, here it would typically be much smaller.
Much smaller. Could it be LHC relevance? TV? No.
Not in these models.
No. Yeah.
So there's a little bit of a tension here. So I would say that one of the most important numbers to actually go out and measure in cosmology for many reasons and would be extremely interesting for spin theory and also transplanting in physics is this slow road parameter epsilon. You cannot get that just from the spectral index because there are two different slow road parameters, epsilon and eta, that and the combination of that that you actually measure. So you have to go out and measure independently these tensor perturbations. And if you see some of those and get the handle of what epsilon is, you have an extremely important input into this game. Okay.
A question again.
Yeah.
I always have a lot of problems with these sorts of models applying to cosmology. You've got a six-dimensional collider, Yao, more or less in there, a D-brain, which is us, moving in this collider.
Well, or we are sitting there. Or
if I've got a sheet of paper like this and it's moving around, it's pretty unstable. wouldn't you have a tremendous instability problem with half of the universe hitting that singularity while the other half of the universe is still on the other side of the sixth dimension, right?
Well, actually, I'm not even sure that you're sitting here. You might be actually sitting over there. There are several of these brains around, and the kind of matter which corresponds to the matter which is involved in inflation are sitting on other D3 brains than you are. You're sitting up here. So this is just part of the picture. There's also the picture that you also need to transfer this energy from here to where you are sitting. So this is just a small part of the
stability problem where you have to try and get the entire four-dimensional D brain to simultaneously, shall we say, move into the same point of the six-dimensional collateral. Anyway, maybe we can continue to say that.
I think your intuition is exactly right. And there's shortly going to be a paper here where we show that you get large entropy perturbations. And that's exactly the same thing that we're talking about.
But again, this was just the introduction. This is not an essential part of the talk. It was just to show you where to the important things to look for. So now, the issue now that I want to discuss, and I will do that in a rather speculative way, has to do with from where does these initial conditions actually come? Well, I want to draw a picture here that I think will also be is also relevant for a lot of the discussion that we so far have had. So again, this now represents these high energies. Up there you have the horizon, and this is what's supposed now to describe what happens during inflation. We have to choose a way of imposing initial conditions. A natural thing would be to choose a specific moment in time, and let our modes start from there and eventually they come out through the horizon. Now obviously here there is a problem here if you are somewhere out here, because then typically you would need to trace this mode back already up to here, and you will go through this high energy regime, and that might be something that you would like to avoid. Another way to impose initial conditions would then instead be to choose a specific scale, and in that case there is no problem of this sort anymore. And then you are faced with the problem how to choose these initial conditions here. Presumably, they will depend on this unknown physics down here. Now, the thing here, I will not in the continuing say very much about what this could be, but I will just sort of argue that it's reasonable to assume that it has a certain properties. And the picture that I will have in mind is the following. That what is happening at lower energy scales here is something which is traditional physics with an expanding space-time. What's happening down here, on the other hand, is something completely different. And the attitude that I will take will be very similar to, I think, what Jens was talking about in Kahn's paper, where I think the clue is that one should think of this other physics here as not being redshifted. So what's happening here at high scales is totally different. We have no reason to think that our ordinary intuition about space-time applies here. So I'm thinking about a fixed scale and physics occurring there, and there's no redshifting of that physics. So things are happening here, and there is some kind of a communication between this and these modes which are created and then expanding and redshifted in the ordinary fashion.
This principle of Lorentz invariance gravity.
Everyone is doing that at this meeting. So why not me? I'm just part of the game here, so I'm not worried about that. Now, actually, just a little parenthesis here. Just a little curiosity. I need to have a name to call this. And Frank Wilczek, he was in Sweden just a few weeks ago, he gave a colloquium about the return of the ether. And he suggested a name in that colloquium to describe this ether-like thing that is permeating everything here. And he wanted to call it the grip. So that's the grip. So that is the word that we'll be using here. We'll be calling this the grid, just as a name for it.
Don't insult the electronic technicians of the computer.
The grid. I will call it the grid, and we can discuss later why that is a good name or why it's a bad. Okay, so the grid. Now, the thing is now, in this picture here, you might be worrying, from where does these initial conditions actually come? Well, in a sense, it might be that the state of the things that are sitting here can nevertheless be traced backwards in time. So again, there might be some kind of initial condition problem here. So there is something happening here early on, which sets up initial conditions for these inflationary modes up here, and it also might do something to the grid, excite it in some way. And then time moves on, these other modes go up here, and this perturbation of the grid remains and affects the mode creation successively here. So that is the picture that I will have in mind. Again, I will not have any detailed modeling of what's happening here. The only thing that I will be using is this idea that there's no redshifting here, and arguing around this, I will also try to come with the limit of how long these perturbations can actually persist in the grid before they are gone. So that is really the aim of the talk, to try to argue for that.
The grid, like a, well, an excited state of the superplankian physics?
Something like that.
Okay, so wouldn't that be pretty obvious to someone who is sort of crossing this region or what have you? I mean, we're really talking about scales that are very short and near the horizon, in some sense.
I mean, it will affect, it will affect the vacuum, the nodes which are created, it will be different, etc.
Right, well, in particular, wouldn't the vacuum look violently different for a typical free-falling observer if you did have such a modification?
I don't know.
In Parantani's model, it's a direct implementation of this idea, does it? It decouples, and then you end up at sufficiently low energy, you end up in the standard vacuum.
Yeah, if it matches, well, if it is basically the vacuum with the Trans-Planckian physics, that's one thing. But if it's some perturbation there,
what I'm saying is small perturbation.
I suppose what we're saying is not clear what and whether even space-time exists as a continuum in the grid. I mean, it might not be even a continuum.
So it has to be cold.
Not too cold. Okay, So this is the kind of picture that I have in mind. And it also reminds me a little bit about what Rich was doing. But you had something that was redshifting in a regular fashion. So this is a little bit more speculative. So.
But you cannot apply effective theory methods to the grid. That's the difference. Right?
I don't think so. I don't know. Okay, so what I will do now for the rest of the talk is discuss a little bit about the conditions here and then the time it takes for these modifications to die away. Now, this first thing here is something that I really wouldn't need to spend too much time on, but there has been some work recently that I think that I need to address, that I can find an opportunity to address now in this context. And so the idea now is that if you go back in time there, how can you expect really that what can you say about the initial conditions, basically, if you go way back in time? Well, basically, you can expect that inflation has a starting point somewhere. That's a very reasonable expectation. And the idea then is, what kind of initial conditions can you expect that you have there? Well, there has been some discussion recently that perhaps one should, in order to learn a little bit about this Trans-Planckian physics, not necessarily look at the super space, but maybe at a lot simpler space. The mean of the space. And this is work by Kaufman and Vadrevan just a few months ago. And mean space, what's that? Well, it's a very simple space. There is no matter density at all. It has a negative curvature, k equal to minus 1. If you plug it into the Friedmann equation, the scale factor just grows with time. It's a very simple thing. And actually, exactly, and that is exactly what I'm writing down here. It's just a simple coordinate transformation from Minkowski space. Part of Minkowski space, that part, okay? So just relax. So it's naively of course, one would expect these Tenplankian effects to be present in any expanding cosmology, maybe also in Milne space. So that is the idea behind all this. Maybe you could learn something by going to Milne space. But then the point is that by matching it to Minkowski space, then, well, in Minkowski space, you wouldn't expect that there would be much extra Transplanckian stuff, really, that would really have sort of a good control of what's happening. There is a unique vacuum there. There is no particular reason to worry here, and that is the argument. Yeah, true. So again, I mean, you could have other initial conditions.
True.
But the idea of this paper by Kaufmann et al. Is then that somehow here you could get the whole problem under better control by the mapping of this expanding space under the Minkowski space. Now, the only thing that I want to say here is that I don't think that you learn very much from this. And the thing is that it's very simple reason. And that is that the Milne space is extremely special. And the thing that is really the clue here is the presence of anti-track surfaces that you have typically in expanding geometries.
But the statement that there is a unique vacuum is not completely correct. There's a preferred vacuum.
There's a preferred vacuum.
Yeah. But still, I have an infinite degeneracy of vacuum.
Yeah. In fact, I mean, if you find other ways to argue against that you can learn anything from mapping Milne space into Minkowski space, I'm happy to listen to that. It's the thing which I wanted to focus attention to is just something which is very well known, and that is that anti-track surfaces and the presence of anti-track surfaces makes it really difficult to actually get started into an inflationary period without actually encountering quite exotic physics. And I just remind you that an anti-trapped surface is a surface, a two-sphere, where both ingoing and outgoing adiabatics are diverging, while in a normal one, they are converging when you go inwards. So then in a typical expanding Friedmann-Robertson-Walk geometry, you find that you have anti-track surfaces outside of the upper radius, basically, and the minimal anti-track surfaces, more or less. So, but then on the other hand, if you go and have a look at Milne space, it's clear that there are no anti-track surfaces there, which is obviously obvious since it's just part of Minkowski space. So it's a very big difference between a general expanding geometry and Milne space, simply because it's a part of Minkowski space. And that makes it a lot more difficult to embed clearly something like the Sitter space into something which is as simple as Minkowski space. And this is something which is well known and has been discussed a lot some years ago. And the argument is clear that an anti-trapped surface you cannot put inside a normal space simply because the change of the divergence when you go along in an aliodesic is restricted if you obey the weak energy condition. So you cannot make these lines change in this way, and therefore this is an impossible situation. So all of this was discussed a lot a few years ago, when people were trying to see whether you could initiate inflation, perhaps even in Minkowski space by some kind of embedded somehow into Minkowski space. And the conclusion was that it's not possible. And there is a couple of different ways that this can go wrong, or you can, I mean, the kind of things that you need in order to achieve it anyway. So if this is the Sitter space, it's regimed then with a positive cosmological constant, in order to have that, you necessarily need to have perhaps a shell of matter which is not obeying the weak energy condition. Then you can get around and do that. Or you might also end up in another situation where you necessarily have a singularity in the space which is outside of the Sitter space. And from that singularity, then things can get into the Sitter space. And clearly, there will be a problem there with the initial conditions. again. And also here, because these modes are clearly going through a regime, a region, which is not obeying the usual laws of physics that we have under control. And this was work by Farigut, Blau, Gundelmann, and many other people that have been involved in that. So to make a long story short, what I wanted to say is that if inflation gets started at some point, that is a very exotic event where really new physics beyond our control is kicking in, either through exotic matter, singularities, or maybe just that the whole universe is nucleating out of from nothing in some kind of, with a partly Hawking wave function or something like that. Really exotic physics. And that means that it's not unreasonable to expect that the initial conditions there, including things which are happening at high energies, including the grid, is something that we cannot really claim that we know very much about. So I think it to be a rather mild assumption that the grid, when inflation starts, gets a real kick and is excited and perturbed, and it's something which is beyond our control and might also have an historical explanation, depending what happened before inflation.
But it doesn't mean that you have a constant cosmological constant in string theory. It may decay eventually.
But you can try some space time back in time. This is just the ordinary singularity. So what I want to continue with now is to have a look at the other end of the story here, and that is how long can the, let's say that we accept that there is some kind of disturbance here, the grid is not in its ground state, it's excited, how long can it be living in that configuration? After all, one could expect there is some kind of back reaction here, which eventually will lead to that the state decay and come into a ground state, which presumably, although it's not quite clear to me, but presumably would also correspond to that the initial state will be effectively be the Bunch-Davis state for the other modes, could be. So how long can we expect that this situation persists? So that is the thing that I would like to discuss. And in this context, I believe that you can perhaps get some little clue by considering the information paradox. So let me just remind you what the information paradox is, and we are going to make a little thought experiment involving a cat. So what we'll be doing is that we take the cat and then we throw it into the black hole and the cat is gone. And I will now formulate the problem. Yeah, I know that. But it's him. So what's happening there? Well, obviously, we know that there's Hawking radiation going on. The radiation is coming out. And now if we believe in unitarity and that information is preserved, then we expect that in the radiation, we will be eventually be able to reconstruct information about the cat that went into the black hole. It might take some time and a lot of effort, but we would be able to do that eventually. So this is the outside perspective. And it's also supported also by calculations in string theory, at least for black holes which are near extremality. It's a lot difficult to actually know what the theory predicts when we are far from extremality. But this would be a reasonable picture from far away. Now, the problem is, of course, that if you had been following the cat in through the horizon, you would have not experienced anything particularly exciting or strange or anything like that. In particular, you would not have felt that you have been burned to pieces and then emitted as Hawking radiation going out. And if we were able to peek inside of the black hole, we would have been able to discover that there is the cat again. And this is sort of a part of the information paradox. Of course, then people are arguing that this is not the paradox because these two different pictures of the same thing can never really be coming in contradiction. And there's the idea of black hole complementarity, because you cannot really come out again and say that everything went well, and you cannot go in and catch up with, let's say, the cat that went in before the cat is hitting the singularity. So that is the general idea. Okay, so let's say that you are reasonably satisfied with this picture. Now, if you go to cosmology, is there any reason there to expect to find a similar situation? Let's go to the city space. Let's go to inflation. There again, there is a horizon. And let's say that from the perspective of the cat, cat goes out through the horizon, and we can't really, well, from the point, from this point of view, the cat will be more and more redshifted, and in that sense, eventually become invisible. There's not much of an information paradox yet. Now, assume now that the radiation, that there is again radiation also in the city space, as expected to be, then you could, if you make an analogy with the black hole case, expect that again through from that radiation, and we'll come back to possible limitations here, be able to reconstruct again what went out through the horizon. Now, here it seems as if you can really get into a paradoxical situation, because after all, inflation will eventually end, and the horizon will move, and whoops, now you have two pictures of the same cat, kind of a duplication. Yes?
Why are you going to insist the information of the cat comes out in the desiter radiation?
I will say a little bit more about that. At the present time, the only thing is that I'm saying that all horizons work in the same way. I know, of course, that the desiter horizon is very different because, of course, it's observer dependent in another way, which makes it a lot more complicated.
And it's not a trigger space, it's inflationary space. I think there's a crucial difference.
But during inflation, it's effectively more or less the same. If inflation...
I don't think this is the case. Not for the purpose of desiter radiation. I don't think this is true.
But the time scale is completely different.
Actually, there's something much worse here. Now we're going to make a major problem over the issue of horizon. Cosmologists tend to use this phrase, entering and leaving the horizon. And it's utter nonsense. If you enter and leave it, it's not a horizon. What cosmologists typically call a horizon is a speed of light surface. And it's an estimate of where you think, you know, there's a certain amount of decoupling. But the horizons that cosmologists are talking about when you're entering and crossing the horizons are not honest-to-God horizons in any sense of the word.
What's that?
A long discussion with the relativity community. There's a long paper by Alison Rothman called Lost Horizons that I recommend you read, because it's critical, especially to an argument here. I'm happy enough if you use the phrase entering and leaving the horizon, as long as we just realize it's a statement about freeze out of modes and defreeze out of modes. But here it's become critical because you've used the word horizon in two different senses in different parts of the same talk.
What I'm saying here when I'm referring to horizon here is that the object we see going away here will be more and more redshifted. And there is a point where that redshift goes to infinity. And that is the thing that effectively, to me, is what I define as a horizon, which is very similar to what happens if you have something that you throw into the black hole. So that is what I'm saying. So, and from that point of view, I make this, which some people might think to be a leap of faith, is that I also associate with that horizon the temperature of the city space.
But we don't understand where the microstate is. We don't understand where the microstate is.
I was just going to say, but that relates to what Jens was saying, is whether or not it's really a horizon depends on the asymptotic structure of space-time, right? I mean, it depends on whether inflation ends at late time or it doesn't, right?
But it's the same thing with the black hole. It's the same thing with the black hole that evaporates. And if you believe that you now inherently preserved and so on and so forth, it might be that effectively there aren't any real horizons there as well. If you wait long enough, they will sort of. So all horizons is in a sense a fact. To some degree of approximation. So that is the point of view that I would like to take. So then the question is now whether there is really a paradox in this. If you accept this setup here, and that the radiation which is coming towards me includes information about what went out through the horizon in the same sense as in the case of the black hole, do we have a paradox here? Well, I think what is crucial here is the time it actually takes for this thing to actually happen. And here you can estimate what that time is in just the same way, I would say, as you can do in the case of black holes. There is a certain time scale here, which is a time scale for information to actually be delivered from this horizon, being in the black hole, or as I claim here, being a cosmological horizon at this time. And that time is, and you can make various arguments for that, and this is sort of just a poor man's argument for what this timescale could be, and there is a more elaborate argument by Page in the case of black holes. And the thing is that what you need to keep in mind is the emission rate of photons from this horizon is extremely low because the temperature, the wavelength of the temperature is of the order of the horizon scale. So it takes a really long time. And at the end of the day, and I don't go through the argument in detail, but at the end of the day, the time scale, the characteristic time scale for information to come back to you is of the order of R2. And this is the result for a black hole, where R is the mass or the size of the black hole, or if you wish, it's the inverse temperature of the black hole. And the question now is whether you can apply the same reasoning to the case of the cosmological horizon. If you can, well, then you have an estimate now of how long time you need to wait in order to actually be able to claim that the cat has been transformed into radiation. And it's only after that time that you can actually start to worry that here there might be a problem. It also means that inflation needs to proceed at least this long in order for this situation to arise. Now, the question now is, if now inflation proceeds this long, what happens then? Can I start to measure what is in the radiation? Well, there is a possibility here that there is a problem of actually retrieving the information from the radiation. And here you come into a possible conflict with holographic bounds and other things. And it has to do with the fact that if you start to measure and start to actually collect quanta in order to really gather information from the radiation, then you grow, obviously. And you have lots of entropy associated with you, and that entropy you have also to divide together with the entropy corresponding to the horizon, and there is absolute limit given by the cosmological constant of how much information in total you can have. And that means in practice that if the horizon radius stays fixed, that you cannot access more than a portion of the information in the radiation. This argument is well known. On the other hand, I think that there is a loophole here if inflation eventually is going to end, because then the horizon has the possibility to recede. And that means, I think, that you can extend this period and eventually be able to tease out this information which is present in the radiation anyway. And if you can do that, then it seems as if you are risking to end up with a paradox anyway. Now, there is another possibility here, and in order to get an estimate of the same time scale. And the thing is that this is a very long time, this R cubed over Planck scale squared time. And extremely long time. And actually, you can start to wonder whether it's any, whether it's a possibility actually for any physics, any physical object to even exist this long a time without being severely affected by the radiation which is around you. Because you have this radiation in the city space. So you can estimate what the frequency of interaction with the radiation would amount to, simply by saying that the only interaction that you cannot turn off, that would be gravity. And imagine now that you have that you all objects, including the grid, is constructed with some kind of a Planck scale size cells, then the cross section would be order of the Planck scale. You have the radiation which is coming in here, and you can calculate that the typical time for interaction with this temperature is of the order of R cubed. So you would then, by typical, just ordinary way of interpreting such an interaction rate, interpret that this is some kind of thermalization time. So the idea would be that if you wait this long, which is the time needed in order to actually be able to claim that there is an information paradox, you necessarily end up with a state that has been completely thermalized, and no observer can last longer than this. So the outcome of this little exercise then is to put in focus this time scale, which I now write in terms of temperature. And this time scale has been argued for with other arguments as well, and Steve has been involved in such discussions, that this is the time scale in the city space which, when really local field theory and local physics start to break down. And I was trying to argue for this time scale in a different way. Now, you can then start to think, what can you do with this time scale? Well, the conjecture that I'm proposing here, which in this weak form, would be that this is really the thermalization time for the city space. If you wait this long, even either if you argue respect to things going out through the horizon and the times it takes for the radiation to come back and things start to get recycled in form of radiation, or whether you look locally at interaction with this thermal background, the thermalization time is given by this. So if you wait this long, the city space, all perturbations in the city space have simply died out. You could also, if you're really bold, say that there is a message here which is much more general, that this time scale is something that works not only in the city space, but in general. And the thing that is really essential here is the presence of a temperature. Now things get even more speculative than the thing that I so far discussed. So what I now want to say, before coming back to the cosmological application of this, is just to play a little bit with this time scale and to see whether you can run into any contradictions. Is this time scale in contradiction with anything that we know in physics? Would we have expected to encounter any dramatic phenomena at this time scale? Well, one thing that one could worry a little bit about is, of course, in the early universe, where we have high temperatures lasting for a very long time. Well, then the thing is that actually, if you take this interaction rate given by T cubed and integrate over time, clearly we need this time scale to diverge if we really want to make sure that these interactions have time to act. So this is just the same argument as when you talk about freezing out of interactions in expanding space-time. Well, it turns out that it only diverges if the scale factor grows slow enough. And that means, actually, that you end up in an exotic regime. And the conclusion is that you need a box to prevent radiation to redshift. Otherwise, this will not give you an interesting effect. So where can we find boxes? Well, there are lots of boxes around. And for instance, this room here. Let's put in room temperature into this equation. Room temperature gives rise to a time scale of the order 10 to the 39 years. Now, let's think, what could happen, actually, if this physics was important somehow at this time scale? Well, after all, this should somehow, through these contrived arguments, be related to also black hole evaporation. What is characteristic for a black hole which is Hawking radiating? Well, one thing which is characteristic is that all quantities like baryon numbers and other things are not conserved. So perhaps if you're following this very speculative route here, you would say that this time scale might be associated with baryon violation, proton decay. But if that is the case, we see that we do not run into any contradiction here, because this time scale is a few orders of magnitude beyond what we know now from experiments. It could have been the other way around, but actually, luckily, room temperature here, it's okay. The core of the sun. Well, here we go down to 10 to the 25 years. Well, that seems to be a rather long time here. Clearly 15 orders of magnitude beyond the age of the sun. So clearly one wouldn't expect any dramatic effects from here. But one needs to think a little bit more carefully here before being sure that there is no danger here. And that is that, let's say now that these effects occur, let's say that there is baryon decay at these time scales in the sun. But the sun consists of many, many, many protons and neutrons, and that means that these effects are occurring all the time. And you can calculate the rate from here. And that rate turns out to be a few orders of magnitude, several orders of magnitude below what is the rate of fusion in the sun. And the thing is, and the reason why I compare these rates is that the only thing that you could imagine being a signal from such an event from the interior of the sun would be a high energy neutrino. These high energy neutrinos would be of the order of some tens or hundreds of MeV or so. It should be some fraction of the GeV that is present in a proton if the proton is decaying due to this effect. Now, happily then, the rate of production is much lower than the thing which comes from fusion, so we are safe there. On the other hand, if you compare with neutrino production from neutralino annihilation, the kind of things that one wants to measure with the ice cube, the production rate is much lower than this predicts. So these numbers which come out from this is somewhere in between, both in energy and rate. And that would suggest that you would need to make a much more careful analysis here to see whether you get into conflict with anything or any of the kind of things that people are actually measuring. You could also put in TeV temperature here, and then you find hours, but I don't know of any way of realizing this in practice. Another thing, which is even more speculative, after all, if we have this time scale now, why not play around with it? We can also realize maybe fusion here on Earth. So let's have a look at ether, fusion at ether. What can you expect there? Well, there is a condition called the Lawson criteria, which tells you what you need, a combination of density, time scales, and temperature in order to get useful fusion. So let's plug in some numbers here. Let's plug in a volume. Ether will be a very large facility, and the temperature will be of the order of a few hundred million degrees. And you find them, and they actually will reach the Lawson criterion. And then you find that the product of the number of nucleons and the time scale here is of the order of 10 to the 16 years. Now, with the temperatures which will be available here, there is a few orders of magnitude left there. But the only thing that you need to do is to run this a few thousand times, where this tau here, the typical time scale here, would be of the order of a second or so. So what I'm saying is that if this time scale, and I admit, obviously, that this is very speculative, but what I'm saying is that if this time scale is related to new physics with that temperature, that would be accessible in a fusion reactor. It would maybe even accessible by looking at the sun. I haven't considered that.
So that would be interesting for LHC.
But I think the time scales are much too short.
This volume is not the volume where the reaction is going to occur.
I think it's a quite large volume.
But I
looked at
the whole machine. No,
it's the volume.
It's not the volume where you're going to get this.
It's a quite large region. It might not be this large, but it's a large portion, actually. And even if you cut out a factor of 10 or something like here, you still get numbers which are not outrageous. Okay, so this was. I really have to keep the speed here. So this was the possible application of this timescale outside the cosmology. Now let's go back to cosmology.
Do you think this could affect the LHC at all?
No, I don't think so. Really? I think the timescales and the amount of matter is much too small. So, So let's say now that this timescale is also relevant, and I think this is much more secure ground, that it would be relevant in cosmology. What about the Trans-Planckian problem? So recall then the picture here again, where we have these initial conditions setting off some perturbations of the grid here. That shouldn't be too controversial. And then the question is, how long can these persist in the grid? And I have argued that time would be of this order of magnitude. Now, let's see, what will that correspond to in a typical inflationary scenario? Well, the number of E-foldings before thermalization then can be estimated in the following way. We simply take the Hubble scale, multiply with this thermalization time that we have estimated, and if we then plug in Hubble scale, which is a few orders of magnitude below the Planck scale, which could be even smaller than that, obviously, or the scale could be larger, then we find that we have at least 10 to the 8 E-foldings. So that means that, if this argument is correct, that the inflation starts with a heavy kick at the grid and lasts for 70, 80, 100,000 millions of E-foldings, the effect from the grid will nevertheless persist, giving the possibility that the modes which are created out of it will be in excited state, leaving an imprint on the sky. So that is the outcome of the argument. And I believe that even if you don't really believe all these applications beyond cosmology, I think that this argument is on slightly more solid ground. So if we then go back to try to fit this into a picture of string theory even, and even with a string landscape, and this is sort of a more artistic way of viewing the string landscape. This is actual real picture of the string landscape taken from a paper that I wrote together with a couple of graduate students and postdocs, where you have a particular solution of a type 2B string theory, a flux vacuum, and you can see a particular minima here in the landscape that we have zoomed in on. Now, if you have this picture in mind and try to think about what would inflation, how would cosmology act in such a background, how would these ideas that I have presented, what kind of relevance would they have? Well, let's say here that we have a potential looking something like that, and the universe starts out somewhere here, and this is before inflation, it gets some kind of a kick out of some form of quantum gravity effects. It jumps up. This might occur in some particular region, so inflation is just initiated in a small region of space. It might tunnel further, come down a little bit further, and eventually end into a regime which there's a slow roll and inflation, and eventually end up where we are now. That could be sort of the historic picture of what is happening backwards in time from where we are now. And the question that then needs to be answered is, how far back can we actually see?
Because I'm at a stable vacuum, so it could happen in any theory with a unique vacuum.
So you right, I mean, it's, no, but whatever, right. Clearly, I just put it in that picture. Yeah. But the idea then is that there is a limitation on how far back you can see. It might be that in this regime here, we just went through a certain number of e-foldings, and that was not enough to kill whatever information was in the initial conditions that can state that the universe was in here. There might be other inflationary periods preceding the last one with more e-folding, so rather at higher temperatures, which were erasing information. So it's a very tricky thing then to know how far back we can actually see. So what I'm saying is that maybe we can see a little bit back, and maybe we can see further back, and it depends crucially on the history of the universe. But it seems to me that there is a certain limitation on how far back we can actually see. And that brings me to the end of the talk, and as conclusion, I just leave you with these pictures, which are summarizing some of the things that I have said. And as I told you in the beginning, this was supposed to be a speculative talk, and I'm not sure that even I believe more than a third of what I've been saying here, but I hope it might stimulate some thoughts. So, thank you.
When you were talking, when you were talking about your thermalization temperature, did you actually need a physical box for it? Because I was thinking if you...
In the super space, it's automatic. The temperature is the same.
But I was thinking, say, if you're doing early universe, but not this early, but say during when you're making baryonic symmetry. So
now, if...
Will this effect wash it out?
That's exactly what I said. That in that case, if you have a universe, if you have a temperature which is redshifted, then the effect goes away. You will not have sufficiently time for this interaction. You really need to have a box, a temperature which is not redshifting away, which is the case in the city space, or presumably in this room or somewhere.
A real box. So, so it works when you have a real box that you can maintain at constant temperature isolated.
Yeah.
Now, I come back to this analogy between probably black hole. Point, which I'm interested in this. Now, suppose that you have both. So, suppose that your grid incorporates the space-time problem, right?
That would be the idea.
So, the space-time problem would have its own temperature. Like, suppose that you didn't have a receiver. Let me put it this way. Suppose you didn't have a receiver, but you had a space-time problem.
Yeah, and the conditions in that would be set, but it's happening
right.
Early on. Yeah.
So you don't necessarily need the city. You need something that would have this effect of temperature. You need an environment which would box your system. So essentially, your matter system is an open system above that surface, quantum mechanics. So my question is, are you going to have any decoherence in this picture, or in both of the city?
I have no idea.
Because I suspect you would, which would be an explicit why the effective theory breaks down, why you're occurring.
There would be an interaction. It would be an interaction.
That's what I mean.
These two parts of the theory. That's sort of the whole point.
You computed these time scales, which are all safe, based on the value of the mass Planck being 10 to the 19 GeV. What happens if I take seriously, in conjunction with your ideas, speculations that it may be as a GeV scale? How can you use things to rule that speculation out?
No, I would say that the only thing that goes into these discussions here would be, if it's GeV scale, I don't know what we have to do with inflation, for one thing. But if I forget about that, then I would say that presumably the effective time scale might be the important thing, the four-dimensional one. But I should say also that these estimates of these things, since it's a T cube that is sensitive, and it's very sensitive to how you very small numbers that you put in here.
I have a just technical comment on the use of the classical energy conditions. You quoted the weak energy condition a couple of times, but the result you needed it for, I think you really should focus on the null energy condition rather than the weak.
Yeah, that was just a little detour at the beginning,
right.
But I'm happy
thing is to realize that the energy conditions are not fundamental physics. we already know through semi-classical quantum physics that they are all violated by quantum physics.
Exactly, exactly. Oh, yeah.
And the only question is how much they are violated, and are violated enough to cause these intrinsic results.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I should have said that. I mean, that's obviously a source to that. Clearly.
It looks like everyone's getting hungry, so let's thank you again.